You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show:
there is nobody that feels stronger about the intelligence community and the CIA than Donald Trump. I am so behind you, and I know maybe sometimes you haven't gotten the backing that you've wanted. You're going to get so much backing. Maybe you're going to say, please don't give us so much backing.
Is this the meticulous thinking of a Machiavellian genius willfully orchestrating chaos in order to further a sinister agenda, or the desperate burbling of a bungler floundering miles out of his depth? 11 days in, does it look like Donald Trump actually knows what he's doing? My guests Linda Yu and Robert Farks will be here to discuss that, plus the day's other big stories, including the initial efforts of British MPs to get to grips with Article 50 and an escalation of fighting in eastern Ukraine. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, the economist and broadcaster, and Robert Farks, defence editor at the Evening Standard. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with an extended attempt to answer what may be the most important question in the world right now. Does President Donald Trump actually have any idea at all what he is doing? The eventful first 11 days of his administration have provided ample material for all hypotheses, ranging from a carefully calibrated disruption of the existing order in preparation for some sort of coup d'etat to the capricious careening of a clown car. Robert, first of all, your overall impression, are we witnessing malice or incompetence?
I think it's Machiavelli, if it's Machiavelli, but it's written by a Walt Disney cartoon script team.
Machiavelli meets the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, but it is absolutely so. It isn't a question of whether it is better to be feared or loved, as Machiavelli asked in The Prince. It's better to confuse everybody thoroughly. That's what Donald Trump is doing. And I'm trying to answer your question. Of course, it's absolutely the vital one. But I'm confused. I still don't know whether there's a grand plan, whether this man can think strategically. From his body language and his rhetoric, the interior logic of such though be of his rhetoric, I think the answer is no. And I think that's why we're in trouble. He is the infotainer.
Linda, the key word there is confused, which I will freely admit to being as much as anybody, as I have been by the entire Donald Trump phenomenon, which I have called 100%, 180 degrees flat wrong for as long as it's been going on. Do you think he is sowing confusion deliberately? Because this has become a popular theory. I think people want to believe that even if they don't like him, he is actually functioning according to some sort of semi-coherent agenda. Is there a plan here?
I think the problem is he probably has goals in mind. He's just not very much into the detail. So I think he has now done
charitable assessment.
So he has done what he said on the campaign trail. The Muslim ban, although he now insists for legal reasons, obviously, it's not a Muslim ban. It's an immigration control issue, enhanced immigration controls, or however you want to describe it. But that's one example, I think, a very good example of the goal that he set. He said he would do. He's now done it. But the implementation of it apparently hasn't been that high on the Trump administration agenda. In other words, when a president issues an executive order, it's very rare that there's no consultation with Homeland Security, with ICE, that's the Immigration and Customs Service, that's the enforcement arm, with the essentially, it takes weeks to execute even an executive order from a mayor of a town, much less the president of the United States. And I think that's a good example of he's done what he said, which is why his spokesman have been on air saying that he said he was going to do this. None of you should be surprised. But of course, public policy is all about the detail and the implementation and the impact. And that's why I think that's probably why he's, how shall we say it, he's different than previous presidents.
Different, another charitable word. Robert, while we're being charitable, how much of what we're witnessing could perhaps just be explained by inexperience? A new administration lacking at its top end people with much of a CV in government, which doesn't excuse it, of course. Obviously, if you're proposing to run the world dominant superpower, you should have some sort of plan in place before you get there. But how much of it could just be, I hesitate to use as trivializing a phrase as teething problems, but how much of it could be that?
He's got three generals in his administration, and he's got the former CEO of one of the Seven Sisters, and they know all about staff work. And what is amazing is that in his, obviously, his property dealing world, that DJ Trump isn't very good at staff work, because I absolutely follow what Linda has said, but because this just hasn't been staffed. That it's just a piece of paper he signs, says I've wanted to do this all the time. It really is. It is The Apprentice on TV, and therefore his spokespeople get themselves into terrible tangle. The obvious example is poor Kellyanne Conway, and she will be haunted by this for the rest of her life, that there are alternative facts. And unfortunately, I think Mr. Trump can't go on living in an alternative fact world. What I think is striking, be very interested to hear Linda's view about this, is he's not a Republican. He's absolutely, as you suggested in your question, he is outside the machine. Now, what are the machine politicians of whatever stripe going to do about this? Because we're in the world of executive orders, but bills before Congress. And so we haven't really got into that game yet. And how is he going to manage with the majority leader in the House and the leader in the Senate? I'm still in the dark about that.
Linda, on that point, we are starting to see throughout Trump's ascendancy, in fairness to quite a lot of the GOP establishment, a lot of the most passionate and informed criticism of him has come from conservative sources. We're seeing even more of that over the previous 11 days. We've seen some sort of conservative thinkers like Elliot Cohen and David Frum criticizing him quite stridently. We've seen Dick Cheney, of all people, suggest that what he's doing is a bit much. And even John Dean, a man who went to prison for Richard Nixon, has accused him of trashing the American presidency. Now, when John Dean is accusing you of trashing the American presidency, you have wandered off into some very long grass. Is he at all damaged by those criticisms by senior Republicans?
I'm not so sure he is. You think he would be, but if you look at the stance of the White House, I think they feel they have popular support for, namely, the immigration ban, obviously, is in the news. But I would probably say, you know, it's too soon to say, because they can certainly block his further attempts or future attempts, however you want to say it, because the executive's power is delegated. So executive action is intended to implement legislation. So it's ultimately up to Congress as to what powers he's given. And so I think that he does have to bear in mind. And I think the other thing probably to bear in mind, and why it is he's come under such fierce criticism, even by people, including the ones that you've mentioned, and lifelong Republicans, who, as far as I can remember, have always been partisan, I think they're pretty unhappy with reports that Homeland Security are not complying with court orders. I think that's where the Nixon kind of Saturday Night Massacre analogy is being heard. So it's very unusual for the White House to simply put out a statement to say, we are complying with court orders, and then for congressmen to go to airports and say, well, actually, a Boston federal court issued a stay nationwide that you cannot send back. There's different versions of that. But essentially, the ban is likely to be unconstitutional. The answer to that is not we will implement Mr. Trump's ban. It is to appeal the decision and try to get clarification. That's eventually what they ended up doing. But we know overnight he's fired the acting Attorney General, the highest law enforcement official of the country, for refusing to enforce the ban. He's now replaced the head of the Immigration Enforcement Service. I think it's those kinds of actions that just strike too far beyond even, I think, what many conservative Republicans have been able to stomach over the past few days.
Robert, that sacking off the Attorney General that Linda mentions, or the acting Attorney General, Sally Yates, was that really that big a deal? Because obviously she was going to go anyway. She was an Obama appointee. He's waiting for Jeff Sessions to be confirmed as her replacement.
I wonder, he does seem to be in a little bit of difficulty, though, at the moment, Sessions. I'm sure he will get through, but yes, I do take your point, but I get the smell that, yes, we've got problems with Congress, but I do suspect he's got bigger trouble, potential trouble, rather. Let's not anticipate things too harshly. Potential trouble with the law, with people who implement the judiciary. And that is where I think that he will hit another new reality where, you know, you're not all powerful. You're not Machiavelli's prince who can decide whether you want to be feared or loved, and you can go to war or make peace or deceive or whatever. What is so worrying about him, and he set the tone from the inaugural speech, is he is not playing the team, not even as the captain, it seems to be at the moment. He's out on his own.
Linda, if we look at the other team, as it were, what is the smart move for the Democrats at this point? Do they try to find a way to cooperate? Do they just go full sand in the petrol tank? There is reports as we go to air that say the Democrats are going to boycott nomination votes on a couple of his cabinet picks, Tom Price at Health and Stephen Mnuchin, if indeed that's how it's pronounced. It's going to take me the entire presidency to figure that one out, at Treasury. That will force postponements of the hearing. Can the Democrats get any mileage by being obstructionist at this point? It's not like the Republicans can really claim high moral ground on that, having spent the last 8 years doing everything they could to obstruct a Democrat president.
I think this early on in the administration, the Democrats have been sort of feeling the wind, see which way the wind has blown. But the immigration ban this weekend has actually caused them to come out to say that they are going to be more obstructionist, in addition to potentially blocking the Treasury Secretary, which is a very big appointment for President Trump. They're also going to introduce a bill exactly limiting the executive power on immigration that we just discussed. So I think the fact that they can't really, without holding a majority in either House of Congress, do a great deal. What they can do is make public statements, and they can filibuster. So the other issue that's now being debated is that Trump wants essentially a suspension of the filibuster rule. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who is a Republican, is not in favor of this, mostly because of all of the turmoil that's already come across. If they were now to suspend the filibuster rule, where a Democratic senator could stand on the floor and essentially talk endlessly, reading from the phone book, to stop any further appointments or actions, whatever you want to say about the administration, I think it would come across, as they say, it wouldn't smell good. Yeah, it wouldn't pass the optics wouldn't look good, to borrow a phrase from Scandal, the TV show.
Robert, what have you made of the more, I guess, visible opposition to Trump we've seen in the last 11 days, which has been widespread street protests, not merely in the United States, but all over the world? There is a theory which, again, may be crediting him with a little too much forward thinking, that this is what he wanted, that he wanted to provoke a large reaction in order to gauge opposition, in order to give him an excuse to crack down, etc., etc., etc. What have you made of his reaction to those protests?
Well, it's been fairly consistent, as you say, the pathology, the behaviour has been that of the campaign. You know, these are bad people, those people don't count. We've had it from the get-go, from the crowds at the inauguration all the way through. But I do think we're just at the very beginning of the beginning in the United States, because if you have really big law and order issues, not of the kind that he's been mentioning in Chicago, where he didn't massage the figures, he just mashed them into the ground. It was absolutely untrue that crime figures have been increasing in Chicago. It's absolutely the opposite. But here in Europe, it's something else. And if he sticks a little toe here, and I think that this is where people are worried in the UK, that it will be a cue to go to the streets of people who are frustrated and angry at people, so-called representatives, who claim to represent the people, which is the big word, because the people means the people who support us, the rest, the opposition, are not the people. And I think that this is going to be pervasive in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands. If Wilders makes a gain, I think he will make a gain, but not probably be in any position to take power. That's a bold prediction, I know, in the Dutch elections, but it really is looking like that. But I think particularly when it comes to France, but it's other places that may not necessarily have urgent elections, where I think that there's probably going to be a lot of activity on the streets because they are so frustrated. I'm afraid it's not the cosy liberal consensus, which you and I have talked about in the past. It's the disturbed liberal conscience, which is the way that they would say. And I think that I have the feeling, not of 1848 or 1849, I have a bit of a feeling, like really go back this far, there's a whiff of 1968 about this. There's real pressure that people who see themselves as progressives, they too are fed up with the system in the way that it operates. The House of Lords, the overbearing judiciary, I'm allowed to say that in the UK, where it's enormously powerful, much the same in France, where you get the ENARC, the central schools ruling. I think it's very worrying because I think the opposition is fragmented, not just on the right, but right across the piece in Germany. And Trump, I think his presence, his very presence, will be a catalyst rather than a cause to this thing that I really do sense building up.
We'll come back to that in the second half of the show. A final thought on this from you, Linda. We saw yesterday, I think it was, workers at 8 Google campuses staging a short stoppage by way of protest against Trump in general. I think mostly about the immigration law or the immigration executive order. There's some small amount of agitation for a more widespread general strike. I don't know if that's going to catch on or not. Is that an appropriate response to Trump at this point? Is he that great a danger?
Well, it's interesting that former President Obama has said that it is right for people to go and speak out. And actually, he had a rule that many former presidents do, which is they don't interfere, not especially within the first few days of the next president's presidency. So I think that gives you a sense of how strong the sentiment is about this immigration ban and some of the stories that have come across about, as I say, clashes with court orders. That's, to many people, the very worrying development in terms of American politics. Now, whether or not America would have a general strike or a nationwide strike, the kind that we've seen in Europe, America hasn't had one for about a century. I think the last one was probably the interwar period, if not shortly thereafter. And it'd be the equivalent of every European country coming to a stoppage in terms of scale, because America obviously is a big, big place. And also, let's not forget, trade unions are not as powerful in America. They haven't been for a long time. Actually, what I think you'll see instead are protests organized by, you mentioned there, Google, also other across university campuses. There's a lot of other organizations, the ACLU, who have called for protests. So they may not stop necessarily the public transport system, but you never know. New York taxis decided to strike, so they could end up blocking some cities. We'll see.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Linda Yu and Robert Fox. Coming up next, the UK's ongoing attempts to clean up after its own populist revolt.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design program Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Linda Yu and Robert Fox. Now, the US is not, of course, the only constituency which has recently voted for something that most of its political establishment would prefer it hadn't. Here in the UK, MPs have been debating the legislation which will trigger Article 50, the process by which the UK will begin its egress from the EU mandated by last June's referendum. If that isn't tricky enough, the same lawmakers also face the prospect of having to debate whether or not to withdraw the offer of a state visit to President Donald Trump after 1.7 million and counting petitioners demanded his uninviting. Linda, what have you made of today's debate as such? Have we actually learned anything, or are we just seeing a rerun of the campaign arguments?
I think largely the latter, I'm afraid. And I think this is probably why the latest calls by Dominic Grieve and others are that the white paper, which is essentially would be a document that set out more of the details of what Article 50 triggering and the Brexit plan would be, should have been presented before the MPs debated today. They've taken an informal vote tomorrow and a final binding vote next week in both houses of parliament. But because there isn't necessarily a roadmap to debate, I think that's become now a big point of contention, because what we have heard today are, some of the well-worn arguments that we had heard leading up to the referendum.
Well-worn, another charitable, tactful description thereof. Robert, the one real headline that struck me was, and this has been floating around now for a couple of days, was Nick Clegg's claim that Germany offered Theresa May something of a get-out, a break on freedom of movement in return for a softer Brexit, and she knocked it back. Does that sound plausible?
Yes, it does. Because what is so interesting, and it's the P word again, is how Mrs. May, who campaigned ostensibly, not very loud and not very long, for remaining in the EU,
because remarkably quietly,
I think she is the captive of the populist wave, which we have seen with the Brexiteers and the United Kingdom Independence Party. Because, and here we do see a synergy between her and President Trump, they seem to be prepared to work against their legislatures. But for the UK and a UK prime minister, this is a peculiar paradox in two respects. Because the battle cry, if I can use that, was let's repatriate sovereignty. John Redwood, who is an outspoken Brexiteer in the Tory ranks today, said, I would have left Parliament had we not restored the sovereignty of Parliament. But he and his like don't care for the sovereignty of Parliament. They won't give Parliament the right to amend, to have a final vote on the deal if and when it's ever done. And I think that there are reasons now to have severe doubts about that. I've just been in Italy with a lot of Eurocrats and technocrats, and they were just explaining to the great unwashed, the bad people, as Mr. Trump would call them, of the UK, international and Italian press, how very, very difficult this is all going to be. And the second thing about Mrs. May is bringing it all home to Britain, and she seems to be doing her level best by hook or by default to break up the UK, because she's got the leaders of the administrations in all three constituent parts, apart from England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, absolutely against her on this. And it is really looking like a constitutional train crash of a major order in terms of British history. Not that the outside world would care over much about that.
I do want to get, before we move on, a very quick thought from each of you about the Donald Trump state visit. I mean, it would be an iffy thing to try and undo at this point. But Linda, does he deserve one? Should it go ahead?
I think there's an argument about it's a fait accompli in the eyes of Trump, who is, as we know, slightly reactionary to perceived slights. but on the other hand, I can also think it's good for Parliament to debate this on February 20th as to whether or not it should be downgraded. He can visit, but perhaps the Queen will be unavailable. That being said, I do realize lots of people have mentioned this, that there have been state visits by some people, like Robert Mugabe and perhaps others, the Queen.
Some fairly rum customers,
yeah,
yes.
And my favorite little story about this is that, you know, women can't drive in Saudi Arabia. So the Queen, when she hosted the King of Saudi Arabia, made a point of driving him around on her estate.
A very quick thought from you, Robert. State visit for Donald Trump or not?
I think Linda is absolutely right. You can't undo it now. But the big issue is whether he's going to be allowed to make a speech to a joint gathering of the Houses of Parliament in Westminster Hall. And I think that really would add injury to really what is quite a big insult already. But it shows you how insensitive Mrs. May is, how closed she is with her leadership, with her consigliere, a very, very small bunch, that she didn't see this coming. I mean, there could be, if the Downing Street demonstration of last night is anything to go by, multiply that up and we could have millions on the streets of the UK.
I think he can anticipate quite a welcome, yes. Finally tonight, however, while predicting Donald Trump's presidency further than 5 minutes ahead is obviously a fool's errand, one consequence of his accession, which could have been anticipated, was an emboldening of Russia. Fighting has escalated significantly in eastern Ukraine in the last few days, to the extent that preparations are underway to evacuate the Ukraine-held frontline town of Avdiivka. Apologies to any residents for my mispronunciation. Currently without water or electricity, and where overnight temperatures are currently circa minus 17. Robert, is this escalation and Trump's inauguration entirely coincidental, do we think?
We have to talk about the other unpredictable, which is Mr. Putin, about this. And it is very much in the pattern of his virtual or hybrid war. Now you see me, now you don't. You do something tough and then you talk it up and then you try and talk it down. And in the confusion of the United States in this period, I think he was going to do this anyway, because he has to put a marker down with Trump. He knows Trump isn't over concerned about the fate of Ukraine, quite the opposite, given the business dealings in the past.
His exact words were, "I don't care," I think, when he was
so
cast,
this is where this. This is where Putin has to explore, and this really is Machiavellian. It is where you go with the big opportunity. You court Madame Fortune, as Machiavelli would write. And I think he was bound to do this, because what he is making it clear to Trump, who he sort of regards as quite rightly as a quasi-friend, is that NATO isn't going to put the heat on this. I'm going to put my marker down. We're going to have confusion. I am going to have the Donbass virtually or in reality. And you're not going to get it into the NATO or the NATO-European sphere of influence.
Linda, you mentioned Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier, who doesn't appear to be an unequivocal fan of Donald Trump. And there is a potential source of conflict here in that he believes that not only should sanctions against Russia not be lifted, they should in fact be significantly extended. Is there a way I can ask you this question without asking to predict what Donald Trump's going to do in a given situation? That would be terribly cruel on your first appearance on Midori House. But if Donald Trump does wish to make nice with Russia, as he said he does want to do, might that prompt a more open conflict with the GOP?
Yes. I think that the reason why even Donald Trump was somewhat equivocal about the outcome of his phone call with Mr. Putin and his press conference with Mrs. May, they were asked about Russia and Ukraine. He actually was not as forthright as he normally would be. And in fact, I think at the presser, they both agreed the Minsk agreement from 2014 needed to be fully enforced. And Mrs. May, although I have to add, Mr. Trump did not verbally say anything. Mrs. May said Trump is 100% behind NATO. So, yes, I think this is lifting sanctions would be hugely problematic for his own party, never mind many, many others in the international community. But I also have no doubt that Mr. Putin is taking this opportunity to make inroads into an area which is a very key transit point for logistics to get into the Crimea,
which he's had difficulty with. But I think you always have to look at the part of the painting you're not supposed to be looking at. It's the essence of a conjuring trick. I think there's bigger trouble potentially, and I think Putin is well aware of this, over one of the following three, but I bet they're going to come up by the end of May. Iran, Israel, attached to that, the South China Sea, and the biggest unpredictable, even more unpredictable perhaps than Donald Trump, North Korea.
Well, plenty to look forward to there. Thank you for that, Robert. Robert Fox and Linda Yu, we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephen Kenny. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, 1900 at Section D, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time tonight. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. As always, for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Thank you.